We continue this week with our season of Revelation, that funny book at the end of our Bible. A book that Martin Luther would have consigned to the editing floor had he had his way. He didn't appreciate the author's threats and promises for those who kept or disobeyed his words, their words, and he complained that Christ is neither taught nor acknowledged in it. Now, not that I want to argue with Martin Luther, but I suspect he was suffering from a lack of imagination. For me, this funny book, whilst full of wild and wonderful descriptive text, has Jesus written all over it. The passage we heard this morning is perhaps the best known of all the book. It's heard most often at funerals. Its promise of a place where death will be no more and tears will all be wiped away are comforting words in the place of grief. But like other often heard passages, we do a disservice to it, limit its scope to that particular use. It's like only ever hearing 1 Corinthians chapter 13 at weddings. We don't get the full message of only applying it to that situation. Chapter 21 of the book of Revelation is a rich text, and there's so much to dig into and explore. And I invite you now to join me on a journey into some of my thinking about it. John, the author, sees a new heaven and a new earth. He sees a city, a stunningly beautiful city, so beautiful it's like a bride arriving for her wedding. Every effort made to be as beautiful as it can be. And then the voice. Now God's home is with people. He will live with them and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them and he will be their God. He will wipe away all tears from their eyes. There will be no more death, no more grief or crying or pain. The old things have disappeared. It sounds wonderful, and it is. But the danger in only ever hearing this passage in the context of mourning is that we see it as an image of some far-off heavenly place, when what is being described is what God is offering in the here and now. This passage is about heaven on earth. Last week we heard some great songs, one of which was the Belinda Carlisle song, Heaven on Earth. The lyrics could have come from today's passage. They say, in heaven love comes first, we'll make heaven a place on earth. Heaven is a place on earth. That's what I think is being promised in John's revelation. Not some distant destination when we die, but heaven in the here and now. This revelation is God once again renewing everything. God's story, as we heard from Andy and Ada, is one of constant renewal. From the beginning with Adam and Eve, to Noah, with Moses and Jeremiah, all pointing to this new fresh start that God offers. And of course, the ultimate expression and demonstration of God's love, Jesus, whose death took away the sin of the world. Not just you or I sin, but all sin. I want to venture to suggest this passage from Revelation offers a reminder of God's universal love, because no one is exempt from it. I don't know what you think heaven is or where it is. We each have our own imaginations, and in those imaginations, some concept of heaven, whether that be the image of floating clouds so often portrayed in Sunday school books and films, or something else. I'm not sure I can even conjure up a satisfactory image for myself, but what I do believe is that wherever heaven is, it is where God is, and it's where I look forward to seeing God face to face. I am a universalist who believes that God's love promises us all a place in heaven. Because I can't reconcile the idea of a God who made each of us in his image and yet fails to welcome us all. And yet in this passage, I'm confronted by an image of hell. It says there, but cowards, traitors, perverts, murderers, the immoral, those who practice magic, although I think Paul is exempt, not that kind of magic. Those who worship idols and all liars, the place for them is the lake burning with fire and sulfur, which is the second death. What if this place of fire and sulfur is not so much a place but a state of being? What if those who feel they are unworthy of God's love are faced at the last with the torment of still not knowing God's love? And that's what's being described here. That's a lot of ifs. But I'm content to sit with this uncertainty because it fits with my understanding of a God who loves each and every one of us. I read a wee story that might help illustrate this way of thinking. Reverend Dr. Janet Hunt is a Lutheran minister in the United States, and she spent some time as a prison chaplain. And she recounted in an article that I read a relationship that she had struck up with an inmate at a women's prison. And she writes this: the one I went to see had little or no experience with the church, with any church at all. I became acquainted with her and her need through one of the ministers in our ministries of our congregation. And so it was that as one serving as her pastor, when I went to call on her, I was told I could not bring her much, but I could bring her a Bible, and so I did. When I put it down in front of her that first time, she clearly did not know Matthew from the Psalms or Genesis from Revelation. I gave her a quick overview and then showed her where to find Isaiah 43. This, as some of you may know, is a passage which resounds in my own history and experience as a pastor, for it was passed along to me by a retired pastor who helped mentor me when I was young. I've called you by my name, you are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and through the rivers, they will not overwhelm you. We shared several visits after that first time we opened her Bible together. Sometimes she would come with specific questions about what she was reading. Every time we sat down, I would pray with her. And in March, she was sentenced, and since then, she's been incarcerated several hours away. Now, I confess, at the point of her incarceration, I got busy. I had not forgotten her, but I also had not taken the time to spend even the few minutes it would have taken to write a note to tell her so. And then 2 weeks ago, a letter came to me, filling me in on how she was doing. This time, I sat right down and wrote a quick response and got it out in the next day's post. This week, she replied, and I share part of her letter here. The inmate had written, I know that God is with me and helping me to get through the days. I thank God every day for continuing to help me with love, patience, understanding, and strength. I've prayed not only for my friends and family, but also for the people I don't get along so well. And she continues, there is a lady that stopped me in the bathroom last night and asked me if I ever feel like the black sheep of the family because I'm here. And my response made her smile, and she thanked me. I told her, no, I don't feel that way. I then told her to always remember that God loves her and gave his life for her. And she agreed. I then asked her to read Isaiah 43. I also reminded her that she's never alone and she's worth more than she will ever know. I told her that what room I'm in and to come find me if she ever needed to talk. This morning I saw her and asked her how she was doing, and she told me she was much better. That made my heart happy. This is a wonderful story of God making something new, taking what was, reshaping and repurposing it. Without Reverend Janet, this woman may never have encountered the love of God, and she may well have lived in a place that felt like that fiery, sulfury pit described. It is a wonderful, powerful illustration of God making something new, because that is the nub of our text. It's not about God replacing the old with the new. It's about renewing the existing. The key verse for me in this morning's text is the one, "And now I make all things new." Now I make all things new. Not, "And now I make new things." God takes what is and makes it new. God takes us and makes us new. Our relationship with God was renewed through Jesus, made new, not replaced. A slate wiped clean is still a slate. Forgiven and redeemed, we are still the same and yet different. To bring heaven on earth, God needs us, the transformed people, to be his agents on earth, to take the message of his renewing, redeeming love into our communities and the world. A world described in our reading as the New Jerusalem. Jerusalem is a city, and just like the ancient city of Jerusalem, modern day Jerusalem is like all cities, a place of contrasts. In Revelation chapter 21, and the description in verses 11 to 19, John sees high walls with gates open on each side. Walls are traditional symbols of community and security. Indeed, real security comes from authentic community in which all people feel mutually supported. Gates typically control entrance and exit, but these gates, three gates on each side, are always open. Once again, the love of God, not cosseted away for a chosen few. Some of the most vibrant and dynamic cities in the world are those which are diverse, where people from different backgrounds, different places, live together, side by side. As another writer I read this week wrote, cities are not just places where people live, but where different kinds of people live together. Interestingly, John sees not several cities, but one heavenly city. God envisaged human beings living together as one. The city which in the Bible symbolizes God's promise to his people, Jerusalem, is to become the city of all. Life becomes truly beautiful, even breathtakingly so, whenever and wherever human beings overcome what divides them and live together as one. Our own cities may be places of surprising joy, but sadly, they are often places of distressing poverty, violence, and evil. The shocking truth about our city, Aberdeen, is that it is the highest number of food banks of any city in Scotland. The oil-rich capital of Europe is a place of contrasts, and it's crying out for God's renewing love. The new world of Revelation is not just for us in our cosy Christian huddle. It's a new world that should be available to all God's children. And this is where we have to partner with God and be God's agents. In the text we read about the 12 foundation stones on which the new Jerusalem is built, the 12 apostles, each of which represents us, that imperfect group of people whom Jesus gathered together. They are us, imperfect people called to build the new in the here and now. And that is an eternal truth. As Eugene Peterson put it in his translation of our text, God has moved into the neighbourhood, making his home with men and women. And with God in the neighbourhood, we cannot sit back. We have to act in love because of love. I said earlier that I disagreed with Martin Luther because this passage has Jesus written all over it. God in love for us renews us. And he's done this over and over again for his people throughout his story. And in Jesus found the ultimate expression of that love. And God continues to call his people to be his agents in loving those around us. He promises a renewed world and calls on us to help. So I invite you to switch on your imaginations and consider how we can each do our bit. Imagine a world where people have food to eat, fresh water to drink, and a place that is safe to live in. Imagine a world where people care for each other, help each other, and try to encourage each other. Imagine a world where you have everything you need, where no one goes without and nobody argues anymore. Imagine a world where people stick together and work together. Imagine a world where people who are sick get better and the problems we face are not really problems at all. Imagine a world where people stop pumping poison into our skies and oceans and this air is as fresh and pure. Imagine a world where God and you work as partners. Amen.